Good evening. In the news tonight, whistleblower Chelsea Manning has ended her hunger strike at Fort Leavenworth Military Prison. And today, a pardon Edward Snowden campaign was launched.
And his actions resulted in widespread reforms, both in law and in technology, that protect Americans and individuals across the globe.
With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Wednesday, September 14th, 2016. The U.S. and Israel have signed a new aid deal that will give the Israeli military $38 billion over the course of 10 years. It's the largest such agreement the U.S. has ever had with any country. After months of negotiations, the unprecedented deal was signed at the State Department today. The aid totals $3.8 billion a year, up from $3.1 billion the U.S. gave Israel annually under the current 10-year deal. It expires 10-year deal. That 10-year deal, it expires in 2018. Under the agreement, Israel's ability to spend part of the funds of... Stop.
Much better.
3, 2... For Wednesday, September 14th, 2016. The United States and Israel have signed a new aid deal that will give the Israeli military $38 billion over the course of 10 years. The difference between this deal and the one which ends in 2018 is an increase from $3.1 billion to $3.8 billion annually, and that Israel will be required to spend the funds only on American military industries. In Syria, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says humanitarian aid is being held up by a lack of security arrangements, this despite a Russia-U.S. brokered ceasefire deal. Ban said he's been in touch with the Russian government, urging them to exercise influence on the Syrian government to let the trucks in. He says he's been in touch with the Americans as well to get Syrian armed groups to cooperate. Ban says 20 truckloads of humanitarian aid are ready. They were supposed to be delivered today, but unfortunately, because of all the arrangements for making sure of the security and the safety of humanitarian workers, including the drivers, the supplies are at the border. Discussions around ongoing violence in Syria and Yemen, as well as Burundi, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Ukraine are expected to be the focus of the 33rd session of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. Daniel Dickinson reports.
The three-week meeting of some 190 member states provides a fresh opportunity to address a range of global problems. For the last 5 years, a commission of inquiry on Syria has presented evidence to the Council of human rights abuses committed in the country. The commissioner's work involves investigating and logging rights violations, so the perpetrators will be brought to justice. This 33rd session of the Council will see a total of 18 independent experts and groups present reports on 42 countries and 40 issues, from the death penalty to violence against women and under-5 mortality. Seasoned Council watchers will also be following the appointment of its first independent expert on lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender issues. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
In campaign news, the Clinton camp announced that she'll be meeting with foreign leaders during the UN General Assembly next week. Plans are to meet with the presidents of Egypt and Ukraine. Her camp is trying to cast Donald Trump as unprepared and unfit to serve as commander-in-chief. Her campaign has also been highlighting ties between Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Some critics, however, are saying that a rapprochement between the U.S. and Russia is a good thing, as evidenced by the Syria peace deal. In Flint, Michigan, residents have gathered to condemn the GOP presidential candidate's planned visit, activist and mom Desiree Duell.
Not once since the beginning of his campaign has Trump addressed the crisis despite having ample opportunity. Now that we are less than 2 months from Election Day, he is coming to our city to attempt to pivot his message, and we won't stand for it.
Give me a break. Mr. Trump, I've got one question for you, and it's a pretty simple one. Where the hell have you been?
Ron Bieber is president of Michigan's AFL-CIO.
Donald Trump, he's been missing in action. He hasn't lifted one finger for the people of Flint. If Donald Trump really cared about Flint, and if he's really as rich as he says he is, He'd pull out his checkbook when he's here today and write a personal check for $10 million to help the families of Flint recover. But we know he won't do it because we know the truth. And the truth is, Donald Trump doesn't give a rip about Flint.
Carrying gallons of dirty water, residents wore T-shirts saying, "Don't drink the water, highly contaminated." Residents say, "Trump, go home. You're not welcome in Flint." And this is the news on WBAI in New York. New York State voters went to the polls on Tuesday to select candidates for the State Assembly and Senate. Ben Max has the story.
On New York's third primary night of this election year, state legislative races in New York City were almost all Democratic, and many incumbents did not face an intra-party challenger. In several state Senate and Assembly races, though, across the city, Democratic primary winners were selected, mostly in fairly low voter turnout affairs, around 15% to 30%, and most will easily cruise to election in November. Some won't even have a Republican opponent. Tuesday's primaries saw multiple vacant seats being all but filled, while several seats being vacated by sitting legislators also saw the election of the next office holder. In what is a fairly rare occurrence, three New York City-based incumbents were actually defeated on Tuesday. They were all in the Assembly, and they were Assemblymembers Alice Cancel in District 65, who was defeated by Yulin Niao, Guillermo Linares in District 72, who was defeated by Carmen De La Rosa, and Margaret Markey in District 30 in Queens, who was defeated by Brian Barnwell. The Cancel loss is significant because that is Sheldon Silver's old seat, the Assembly Speaker, who was convicted on corruption charges. Cancel was part of the Silver machine, and she had won a special election to replace Silver in April. She will now have served a very short term in the Assembly, and she is replaced by Niao. Other winners around the city in open seats or seats being vacated by a retiring member or a member who's left a seat already were Jamal Bailey winning in the Democratic primary in Senate District 36 in the Northern Bronx, Clyde Vanel winning in Assembly District 33, Robert Carroll winning in Assembly District 44 in downtown Brooklyn, and Tremaine Wright in Assembly District 56 further into Brooklyn. For open seats or seats being vacated, the winners included Marisol Alcantara in Senate District 31, which is the uptown seat being vacated by State Senator Adriano Espaillat, who earlier this year won a Democratic primary to replace the retiring Charlie Rangel in Congress. Alcantara was Espaillat's hand-picked successor, and she won in a crowded race, or appears to have won, I should say, given that absentee ballots still need to be counted, and it is not completely clear if she has enough margin for victory if all of the absentee ballots, or almost all, go to her closest runner-up at this point, Micah Lasher. That's something to keep an eye on moving forward. For control of the state Senate, which is the key thing on the ballot in November for all of New York to see if Democrats can take control of all branches of the New York government, Alcantara's election and her pledge to sit with the IDC, or Independent Democratic Conference, which has had a power-sharing agreement with Republicans in the Senate, is of particular interest. Whether Alcantara's move to caucus with the IDC actually matters for Democrats will come down to the results of elections in Senate districts outside of New York City in November. So we'll be watching the lead up to those. For WBAI, this is Ben Max of Gotham Gazette.
A campaign has begun by leading human rights groups to ask President Obama to pardon whistleblower Ed Snowden. Anthony Romero is national director with the ACLU. He says it is precisely the time for the U.S. president to act in his final months.
Presidents normally take some of the most difficult actions of their 8 years in office in the final months. The courts have ruled. Congress has enacted reforms to the law. The president's own advisory bodies have recommended reforms to the programs that Ed revealed. And so we think this is precisely when the courage of the person in the Oval Office who has to weigh all the equities, not just the breaches of laws, but also the public interest that's been served and the public debate that's been sparked.
Ed Snowden is the 33-year-old contractor who, when with the NSA, the National Security Agency, became a whistleblower. This when he gave documents to accredited news media in 2013. It in turn vetted any possible security breaches with the U.S. government and published stories based on the documents. Snowden did not release any material himself, but passed it on to National national security journalists. The material described a global surveillance system that had been rapidly expanding since 9/11. The ACLU's Romero says Snowden's actions resulted in widespread reforms, both in law and technology, which protected Americans and people throughout the globe. He says by standing up for the privacy rights of its citizens, Ed Snowden should be thanked, not punished. And while the human rights groups are not saying Snowden did not break the law, what they are saying is that there were mitigating circumstances which outweigh the case for punishment.
Take, for instance, the fact that former Attorney General Eric Holder has said that Edward Snowden performed a public service. And even President Obama has said that the debate that Mr. Snowden set in motion has made our country stronger. A federal appeals court found that the mass call tracking program that Edward Snowden revealed is now unconstitutional and illegal. The following month, the U.S. Congress passed a reform effort to the National Security Agency's authority for the first time in 40 years when it passed the USA Freedom Act. We've seen tech companies over the last several years enact significant encryption programs that protect the privacy rights of their customers. And even James Clapper has said that Snowden's disclosures accelerated the pace of encryption by 7 years. The global conversation that Edward Snowden's revelation sparked should have taken place before a global mass surveillance program was put in place. That didn't happen. We didn't know about it. They kept the facts and the extent and the impact of these surveillance programs secret from the American people and from the world. But thanks to the revelations of Edward Snowden, we've now had a public debate. Our courts have ruled on the legality of those programs. Tech companies have taken actions. Government officials have had to answer difficult questions from Congress and the public about the extent of those powers. And so we are in a much stronger place because of Edward Snowden's courage and his acts of conviction.
And according to the ACLU, what Snowden did in passing along material to accredited news media is very different from what WikiLeaks does.
WikiLeaks self-published all of the documents and cables and government documents that were given to them. Ed took quite a different stance. He took the documents and turned it over to the respected journalists of the leading newspapers of the world. Their editors and their journalists decided what to publish, in what level of detail, in consultation with the U.S. government, who could rebut whether or not any of the revelations would impede or impinge national security. So it's really quite a different model, and I think it's quite important to underscore the fact that what Dinah said before, the maturity, the responsibility, and the interest in serving the public by those revelations.
And at the launch for the campaign to pardon Snowden, Ed Snowden, via satellite from where he's held up in Russia, speaks to the importance of whistleblowers.
History reminds us that governments always experience periods in which their powers are abused for different reasons. This is why our founding fathers, in their wisdom, sought to construct a system of checks and balances. Whistleblowers, acting in the public interest, often at great risk to themselves, are another check on those abuses of power, especially through their collaboration with journalists. Today, whistleblowing is democracy's safeguard of last resort, the one upon which we all rely when all other checks and balances have failed, and the public has no idea what's going on behind closed doors. The case of the 2013 revelations of unconstitutional activities occurring within our country is a clear example. After evidence of classified wrongdoing was revealed for the first time by our newspapers, some of these programs, which had been operating in secret for more than a decade, were ended or constrained by Congress and the courts. Technology companies have also begun to act, in some cases for the first time, to protect privacy and security in ways that benefit not only our people, but people around the world. This is a positive result. And it's one that we could not have had but for the ability of an individual with knowledge of the government's activities to speak in confidence to journalists. If we are to sustain a free society through the next century, we must ensure whistleblowers can act again and safely as a check on future abuses of power.
Edward Snowden makes it quite clear that what he has done as a whistleblower has nothing to do with the Espionage Act under which he would be charged if he returns to the U.S.
Under the Espionage Act, which is the law under which most modern whistleblowers are charged, it is not possible to receive a fair trial. I've long said that I would return were it otherwise. But the Espionage Act does not permit a public interest or whistleblower defense. Those charged under it are silenced by law. They are prohibited from exercising their right to tell the jury why they acted in their belief to protect the Constitution or the public interest. This World War I era law does not distinguish between those who freely give critical information to journalists in the public interest or spies who sell it to a foreign power for their own. My concern here is not just myself. If I and other whistleblowers are sentenced to long years in prison without so much as a chance to explain our motivations to a jury, it will have a deeply chilling effect on future whistleblowers working as I did to expose government abuse and overreach. It will chill speech. It will corrode the quality of our democracy. It will result in a country that is less free and quite simply less American. The question of whether I, as a whistleblower, should be pardoned is not for me to answer. But I will say this. I love my country. I love my family. And I have dedicated my life to both of them. These risks, these burdens that I took on, I knew were coming. And no one should be in a position to make these kind of decisions. That's not the kind of place that we're supposed to be. But it doesn't have to be. Of course, I look forward to coming home. But I cannot support the persecution of those charged under an Espionage Act when they have committed no espionage. And this is a duty that I believe we all owe to those yet to come. In a final note, I'd like to applaud the technologists, our scientists, and leaders who, since the history of mass surveillance broke, have sought to resist this new and accelerating trend of overreach into our private lives. These efforts, their efforts, to enforce human rights through new means are protecting dissidents from oppressive regimes the world over. And it is only by disprioritizing the improvement of our computer security above our occasional desire to defeat it, that we will be able to protect critical infrastructure such as power grids, air traffic control systems, and water supplies in the years to come. We live today in the greatest crisis of computer security that we have ever seen. And in this time, when hacking and computer network attacks occur frequently and without warning, we must maintain the courage to remind even the well-intentioned, but perhaps ill-advised, that the science here is clear. Reliable, uncompromised encryption is our only effective means for keeping our lights on and our roads open. This technology and the things that have accelerated in the wake of this reporting makes us safer and it must never be weakened.
NSA whistleblower Ed Snowden at the launch of the Pardon Snowden campaign. You can join the campaign and sign on to a letter to President Obama or find out more by going to pardonsnowden.org. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Whistleblower Chelsea Manning went a different route from the one followed by Ed Snowden. In 2013, as Brad Manning, she was convicted of leaking more than 700,000 military and State Department documents to WikiLeaks. This included the widely viewed collateral murder video. It showed a U.S. Apache helicopter firing on civilians in Baghdad. She is serving a 35-year sentence at Fort Leavenworth Military Prison in Kansas. On Friday, she started a hunger strike, which she has now ended. This after the U.S. military agreed to move forward with gender reassignment surgery. This is medically recommended treatment for her gender dysphoria. Evan Greer is with Fight for the Future. It's a digital rights advocacy nonprofit which has been following Manning's case closely.
Chelsea went on a hunger strike, as you said, 6 days ago, after years of being systematically abused at the hands of the U.S. government and denied access to medically recommended treatment for gender dysphoria, which is feelings of, you know, feeling that your body does not match the gender that you identify as. Chelsea ended her hunger strike after the military showed her a memo essentially saying that Chelsea will receive gender-affirming surgery. If this happens, Chelsea could be the first transgender prisoner in the United States to receive this medically recommended treatment, which would set an incredible precedent and help so many transgender people in prison. So this is an important and historic moment.
And while it looks like Chelsea Manning will receive the needed health care, she is still facing obstacles in prison. Some of this stems from her suicide attempt in early July.
This is incredibly important because I think a lot of the media right now is just sort of focused on this as a victory. And it is a good thing, and I'm very relieved for Chelsea that she's going to receive this health care. But the U.S. military is still threatening to charge her and threatening her with potentially indefinite solitary confinement from infractions stemming directly from her suicide attempt in July, which, of course, came after she was denied this health care for so long that the military is now admitting that she needs and deserves. So from our perspective at Fight for the Future, which is the digital rights organization that has been supporting Chelsea, we feel that it's even more outrageous now that the military hasn't dropped these charges when, again, they're admitting that they were denying her health care that she needs and deserves, which was the root cause of her attempt to take her own life.
At Leavenworth, Greer says Manning has been repeatedly harassed by prison officials.
Many of your listeners may remember last year when she previously faced indefinite solitary confinement for outrageous minor infractions, including having an expired tube of toothpaste in her cell and possessing the Caitlyn Jenner copy of Vanity Fair. So, you know, this prison has really done everything they can to harass her, to attempt to silence her voice as an important advocate for transparency, for LGBTQ rights, and for basic human rights in general. But Chelsea is still very outspoken and strong, and I think the fact that she went on this hunger strike and has now achieved something that's going to benefit a huge number of people is a testament to her ongoing strength and to all of the people that have been speaking out in support of her.
And has she gotten them to back off of her cutting her hair?
Unfortunately, our understanding is that this new policy will not impact her hair up until she receives the surgery. So that's another area where the military is really doing this backwards, in our opinion. They've been denying her access to this care. And, you know, the basic thing that she's been asking for is to allow her to grow her hair to the length of her choice. They've been forcing her to cut her hair to the military's designated male length. Again, it's a good thing that they are saying she's going to receive this surgery, but this is far from them giving her comprehensive health care or listening to what medical officials have been saying she should have received quite a long time ago.
So remind us what people can do to show support for Chelsea.
So we have a new petition updated at the website freechelsea.com, where people can take action calling for the U.S. Army to drop these outrageous charges and essentially leave Chelsea alone. She's been harassed and bullied and abused the entire time that she's been in prison. She deserves basic, humane treatment and respect like any other prisoner. And so I really encourage people to sign the petition at freechelsea.com calling for basic humanity and rights for Chelsea Manning.
Evan Greer with the digital rights advocacy group Fight for the Future. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, September 14th, 2016. The news was produced with Daniel Dickinson at the UN, Ben Max of Gotham Gazette, and Rebecca Miles of WBAI News. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.